Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to take on a very timely issue, which has to do with supplements, but not vitamins and minerals. We're going to talk about herbal supplements. A couple of months back, a very disturbing article appeared in the New York Times. It got a lot of play, a lot of publicity. Headline, Herbal Supplements Are Often Not What They Seem. So I decided to go to my foremost herbal authority, my go-to guy on herbs and natural products. He is Mark Blumenthal. Mark and I go way back. I don't even care to tell you how far back we go in the field of natural medicine. He is the founder and executive director of the American Botanical Council, the ABC, which is the leading independent nonprofit organization which puts out a lot of accurate, scientifically based, responsible information on herbs and medicinal plants. He's also editor-publisher of Herbalgram, which is a phenomenal publication. You ought to subscribe because it's chock full of very, very detailed and authoritative information about natural products. Whatever herb you may be thinking about, they've got the lowdown, the latest research, and it's very, very authoritative with research gathered from all over the world. He's made frequent appearances on radio and TV. He's been a very, very capable spokesperson for the natural products industry and for the American Botanical Council. And so without further ado, let's introduce our guest, Mark Blumenthal. Mark, it's a pleasure having you back on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
Ron, thanks for having me back. It's always a pleasure.
And, you know, we do go back a long ways. I guess you can say we sort of grew up together in this field.
Well, it's a pleasure to be able to talk with someone like yourself who has, I'm going to say, at least 30, 35, maybe 40 years experience with natural medicine, and you as a proponent, especially coming from the platform as a conventionally trained medical doctor. It's always a pleasure for me, who's coming from the botanical supplement community and the herbal medicine research community, to talk with somebody who's so up to speed and so knowledgeable about research issues as well as clinical issues and therapeutic issues with patients on these various natural remedies.
Right. So I thought I would give you this forum to address some concerns which arose out of this very, very critical article which appeared in the New York Times. I mean, if I were an ignorant consumer, I would be very, very afraid about herbal supplements. The headline, herbal supplements are often not what they seem, and I'll read you, you know, as I'm sure you've committed this practically to memory, but here's what the author, Anahad O'Connor, science and medical writer for The Times, writes. She says, Americans spend an estimated $5 billion a year on unproven herbal supplements that promise everything from fighting off colds to curbing hot flashes and boosting memory. Well, already she's starting off kind of snarky. She says that they did a survey. Canadian researchers tested 44 bottles of popular supplements sold by 12 companies, and they found that many were not what they claimed to be, and that pills labeled as popular herbs were often diluted or even replaced entirely by cheap fillers like soybean, wheat, and rice. She says that of 44 herbal supplements tested, one-third showed outright substitution, which means there was no trace of the plant advertised on the bottle, and there was another plant substituted in place. She quotes, you know, hold on there because I know this is going to make your blood boil, but she says that she goes to a person that she quotes, the Center for Science and the Public Interest, an organization that's never been a supporter of natural supplements. This person, David Sharp, who's a nutritionist there, says, quote, this suggests that the problems are widespread and that quality control for many companies, whether through ignorance, incompetence, or dishonesty, is unacceptable. And here's the kicker. You're going to love this, Mark. quote, given these results, it's hard to recommend any herbal supplements to consumers. All right. I'll give the forum to you on that.
Okay, well, thank you. First of all, since we're trying to be as accurate as possible and to help clarify the record, Anna Head O'Connor is a he, not a she.
Oh,
so let's just make sure we get the gentleman's gender properly.
It's like a boy named Sue. Okay?
Okay.
I mean, because Anna Head, I mean, somehow it...
I believe it sounds like some kind of a name that I'm not familiar with.
Okay.
And I was actually contacted by the journalist to be a... to inform for research background and for a quote for that particular article you just mentioned. And I was traveling that day, and I basically relegated the interview to our chief science officer, Dr. Stefan Gaffner, who on September 1st of this year, 2013, just joined the American Botanical Council. He's a pharmacist and a PhD in natural product chemistry and pharmacognosy, so he's very, very familiar with medicinal plant research, et cetera. He's now the American Botanical Council chief science officer, and he was quoted in the article. So we did have input into this. We did send a letter to the editor to clarify some of the errors in the article and the apparently uncritical over-reliance on this DNA barcoding study. So let's look at that, because what's happened is...
Yeah, what is DNA barcoding? They talk about DNA barcoding as if that's the way that you're going to determine if products are for real or not. I mean, it sounds scientific. It sounds, you know, like quality control. I mean,
it is.
Right?
It is scientific. It is quality control. And it is a legitimate way to try to help identify the material in an herbal preparation, an herbal supplement or an herbal tea, as long as that material is actually the raw material. If it's an extract, and this is one of the big issues here, if it's an extract, then that's questionable. And let me explain that in a minute. Let me just explain a little bit about what DNA barcoding is. DNA barcoding is just like a barcode you have on a product you buy at the store where you can scan something like that. What they can do is they take little snippets of DNA that show a certain type of sequence that is particular to, in this case, a certain type of plant that is usually specific to that particular genus and species of plant, which makes it unique. And then they can take, instead of looking at the entire DNA, the whole genome of the plant, they're just looking at a certain snippet that they consider to be totally unique for that particular plant.
So it's like a fingerprint for a human
it's a DNA. It's a section of the DNA that is unique, and it's like, therefore, a fingerprint. They call it barcoding to kind of make it similar to what you see in a scanner in a grocery store, because every product in a grocery store or super is going to have its own unique fingerprint, i.e. its barcode. Okay, so there's that, where that comes in. And by the way, I've been sometimes mischaracterized in some of the radio and interviews I've done on this subject since it came up on November 5th and was published in the New York Times. My organization, the American Botanical Council, which is an independent nonprofit research and education organization, as you mentioned at the beginning, has already published in our peer-reviewed journal Herbalgram two articles that basically explain the role that DNA barcoding or DNA testing can and should play in future attempts by various members of the natural products industry and the laboratories that service the natural products industry in order to help authenticate the identity of various herbal products. So we have gone on record, Dr. Hoffman, and to help to make sure that people know in the herbal industry that, just aside from microscopy, which is studying plant material under a microscope to see what the cell structure is of that, for that particular plant that is unique for that particular type of plant, or at least genus of plant, which is a family, kind of a taxonomic or relationship of that plant to other plants in its particular family, so to speak, and I use the word family loosely here, or a chemical testing for certain marker compounds that are specific to certain kinds of plants or groups of plants. In addition to those kinds of testing methods or techniques, microscopy and chemistry, now, in the last decade or so, DNA technology is coming to the table to be what might be considered the most definitive way to ensure the proper identity and authenticity of plant material being used in consumer products like dietary supplements, herbal teas, etc.
So far from pushing back against this or resisting this, you're embracing this. You're saying this is the way to go.
I'm saying that DNA, along with other types of techniques that are actually recognized in various pharmacopoeia, which are compendial standards recognized by various governments like the United States Pharmacopoeia, the European Pharmacopoeia, etc., that in addition to microscopy and chemistry testing, when appropriate, DNA testing can also be appropriate as well, especially when testing raw herbal material. The problem here is not the question of whether or not DNA works. That's not the issue. The issue is if DNA testing is appropriate, or as we say, fit for purpose, when testing plant materials that are basically extracts. And in this particular case, this is somewhat confusing and unclear with respect to this particular study, because one author of the study at a United States Pharmacopeia conference on adulteration that I spoke at in September actually told one of my colleagues and co-authors of the critique that we published on this paper, actually said that they had tested some extracts. The chief investigator, Dr. Newmaster, has said numerous times in various media that they did not test extracts. What do I mean by that? When you extract something from a plant using alcohol and water and heat and maybe other solvents, and the more that a particular material goes through such processing, the DNA is often either compromised or destroyed. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is if you take a powdered extract, you take a liquid extract, you dry it, you take those powders, you put them in a capsule or press them into a tablet, and many herbal products on the market today in North America are in fact dried extracts of the plant material. None of the original ginkgo or milk thistle or St. John's wort from the dried plant is there anymore. They've extracted it out of the matrix and taken many of the active chemicals out of that leaf pout or root or whatever. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, it's very seldom possible in DNA. Sometimes it's possible, but in general, most DNA experts will tell you that DNA is not good at being able, DNA testing is not good at with extracts, because there's seldom any DNA of the plant in the extract, or it's been so denatured and or compromised because of the processing involved as to render the DNA testing useless. So you have to use other kinds of tests, which include, as I've already mentioned, extracts. You use chemical tests, many of which are actually recognized by federally instituted pharmacopeia official standards. So what one of the problems with the article, not the New York Times article, but the original article on DNA testing, is they basically disclaim the existence of any types of ways or methods
other
to analytically
means of
test.
Authentication other than the DNA.
Yeah.
They're saying
they
the DNA is the thing. That's the be-all and end-all of analysis.
Right. These guys are so caught up with the DNA test method that they're either ignorant of or totally dismissive of other legitimate, valid techniques and methods to actually determine what's going on with plant identity. And in the case, what they did in this case, one of the problems is here, and we haven't discussed this yet, but it's a key issue, there were no controls in the study. The one study, the New York Times and so many other publications have jumped on and embraced and said this is an example of what's wrong with the herbal products industry, etc. They're quoting and essentially what is an uncontrolled study. Now, you and I know if there were a study on ginkgo or milk thistle or St. John's wort or whatever in a human clinical study that was not controlled with placebo control or some other kind of control, you and I know, A, it would not ever get published in a reputable medical journal, first of all, if it had a positive response, and secondly, it would not be picked up by any reputable publication as an uncontrolled study.
I think what you mean is, if they're going to study, say, ginkgo biloba, that they should maybe study, extract of crabgrass or something like that to see if it has the crabgrass DNA. And if that doesn't show up, then, the control also is showing no viable material.
That's true too, but also they could have taken that ginkgo material they said that the product was labeled, and they could have done a microscopy if in fact it was actually dried ginkgo leaf, which I don't think anybody is selling hardly at all, because most of the research on ginkgo showing benefits for cognitive disorders, etc., or cognitive function, are all based on a 50-to-1 concentrated extract, and so you'd have to be using an extract which would not be amenable to DNA analysis in the first place,
right.
But nor would it be amenable for microscopic analysis, because there's microscopy would show the plant structures because you've extracted everything. But it would show up if you had a proper chemical test for certain chemicals called ginkgolide A, ginkgolide B, and or bilobolide, which are three chemicals found in ginkgo that are found in no other plant species on the earth ever detected. Mm. And if they had done at least a chemical test to find any of those three marker compounds that are totally characteristic of ginkgo, then and still couldn't find the DNA, then they would know they would have a problem with their DNA methodology in with respect to that ginkgo product, but they didn't do that. So what I'm saying here is not only did they not test control their study, the media has embraced a totally uncontrolled study that shows a negative result for the herbs with respect to their identity. At the same time, they would never do that for a clinical trial if it came out positive if it were an uncontrolled study. You and I know that. So there's a huge double standard going on here.
Well, you know, let's take an example. For example, green tea. You know, it's a plant, and it's got DNA. And if you know, you could tell if you get a green tea bag, and you do, I'm not even sure if this is the case, but like a leaf from a live plant, and you could actually see the DNA. You could determine that that is really from a green tea plant. It has the DNA signature. But if you chemically extract the EGCG, which is one very specific compound from that through a very complex process of purification, you get 98% EGCG, which has all kinds of wonderful properties. It's been well studied. It does all kinds of great things. You may not actually find any DNA left in that highly purified sample. Is that a good analogy?
That's a good analogy. And you might find other what they call catechins, these phenolic compounds from green tea, in addition to your highly purified or concentrated EGCG, but you're not going to find the DNA in there, or any DNA in there is going to be so metabolized or compromised and broken down that it's going to be not going to fit your barcode library for identification, and you're going to come out with a negative, even though, in fact, if you chemically test it, you come out positive that it is from green tea, a green tea extract, and that's what happened in this case here. Now, that's what we suspect, because the results that they came out with, saying that 69% of the products showed no DNA for the plant for which they were labeled, that is very consistent with if you were testing a dried powdered extract. That's the kind of expectation you would find. Not only that, since these extracts are relatively concentrated often, when you put them in a capsule that normally would hold 400 or 500 milligrams of dried herbal material, and you say for St. John's wort, where the average well-known clinically documented dosage is 300 milligrams, if you put 300 milligrams of dried St. John's wort extract into a capsule and you have all that extra space left there, you would add a filler to fill the capsule up, and that could be rice flour or soy powder or whatever, and that's why that explains possibly why they are coming up with these things that they're calling fillers. They're finding DNA for rice, they're finding DNA for soy, but no DNA for St. John's wort.
They're saying that
totally
that it's outright fraud, that it's just like a capsule filled with rice powder, and that people are being taken for a ride.
Well, that's what they're saying, and here's the thing. If, in fact, as we are postulating, based on the evidence that they have, and based on the fact that one of the investigators told one of my colleagues that they were testing some extracts as well, we don't know for sure what they tested, because they won't reveal the name of the product or the actual label information, nor will they actually share samples of the material they tested with another recognized authoritative DNA lab in California who's offered to retest their products in a different lab using similar DNA techniques just to confirm what they've come up with. They've refused to cooperate with that. So basically, we don't know what they really tested, and that raises the question of, well, if they're not going to reveal it and if they're not going to share the information, how do we know? And yet, at the same time, what their results are highly consistent with our supposition and our suspicion that some of these products, maybe not all of them, but some of the products they tested were actually extracts, especially something like ginkgo, where the world standard is an extract, not ginkgo powder off a tree or a ground-up leaf. So what they do is they're actually raising more questions than they're answering, and yet the problem is that the media, the general mainstream media, and many medical professionals are actually embracing this information from an uncontrolled study that may have used a technique like DNA in areas that may have not have been appropriate. They're basically uncritically embracing the results. And let me just say very quickly here that we at the American Botanical know there are problems right. in the herbal dietary.
Right. You're not here to say that the industry is impeccable, because there are some bad players, unfortunately, and they offer products that are weak or adulterated or maybe have contaminants.
Exactly. Not only that, but as you know, Ron, our organization for 3 years has been leading an international consortium of over 100 companies, laboratories, and others that are actually working on what's called the Botanical Adulterants Program, where we are publishing for free access on our website at herbalgram.org articles that actually show which herbs, for the ones that we've tested so far, we've researched so far, which herbs are being adulterated. And so we are being very, very open, very transparent, and very, very committed to the idea of sharing with the public, the industry, the public, health professionals, et cetera, the fact that some of these herbs are either being accidentally or, unfortunately, intentionally and fraudulently adulterated, and that's a big problem in this industry that we're trying to help clean up to the best that we can.
But it is not as pervasive as they suggest. They're saying that there's so much adulteration that nobody knows what they're getting. It could be toxic. It could be nothing in the capsule. And they're saying for the time being, there's such chaos in this in your industry that you shouldn't even bother to take an herbal product. That's what they're
right.
basically saying.
We know of no credible evidence that supports their contention that 69 to 70% of these products were adulterated based on a relatively small sample of 44 products. So those data need to be, first of all, A, they need to redo their they need to release information as to what they actually tested. Secondly, they need to allow somebody else to reconfirm the test that they've been doing using appropriate analytical techniques, as well as not just DNA, but again, microscopy and chemical testing for controls. And then and only then can some of the results that they're coming out with be seen in a proper context. And I have a very strong suspicion, as do many of my scientific colleagues that are involved with this whole thing and are watching this, that their numbers are going to come out significantly lower than what they're claiming.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what I do personally. I mean, I make a small number of supplements. I make an EGCG product called EGC Ultra. And, you know, the label claim is that it's 70% DA, EGCG. And what I do is I ask the supplement, I mean, the provider of this, the company that makes the EGCG to send me a sample. And they say, sorry, we can only send you a kilo. And I say, okay, fine. I'll buy, you know, the deal. I'll buy the kilo and I just want to take a sample. So I send it to an independent testing lab and I have it rigorously tested. And I want to make sure that it is, according to their claim, 70%, and usually I'll get a result at 72%, at 73.5%. You know, it's carefully tested, and we do our due diligence to make sure that that product is what the label claims. You know, our next iteration, there's even a material that's now 98% EGCG. So we test our products extensively. But you know what's interesting in this article in the Times is they immediately, there is an agenda here. And I think you may agree, the agenda is that, you know, the FDA and certain people in science and certain people in government have not been satisfied with a law that got passed in 1994. It's called DSHE, the Dietary Supplement Health Education Act, which offers supplement manufacturers some freedom in terms of introducing supplements not as drugs, you know, pre-approved by the FDA, you know, as long as you obey certain strictures and regulations, you pretty much have the ability to manufacture and sell supplements. And what they're saying is that there is no regulatory oversight by the government, that we're in a free fire zone, that the consumers aren't protected, and we need new laws and legislation and new regulations to protect the consumer. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that the people are misunderstanding what the whole situation. First of all, there are numerous laws and regulations that regulate dietary supplements under DSHE and other laws that were passed subsequently. Matter of fact, in many cases, and I know that some people aren't going to believe this, it's a highly regulated industry as far as the number of laws and regulations that are on the books. The problem is, number one, perceptual. People don't understand that these are not drugs, and they think that somehow they need to be regulated as drugs, as Dr. Paul Offit has done in an op-ed piece called Skip the Supplements that was published just 3 days ago. I think it was December 12th or so, or 15th in the New York Times in the Sunday op-ed.
Yeah, we'll get to that. I want to talk about that because you have some distinct views on that, and I've actually spoken to that issue in a recent podcast.
Okay. Right.
But go ahead with your point.
Yeah, but the point is we published an article in HerbalGram in 2012 and another one previously in 2000 that basically talked about the myth of the unregulated industry. And if you go on my website at herbalgram.org and you type in a myth of unregulated industry into the search box, you get this free article. It's like 5,000 or 6,000 words, written by a University of California, San Francisco professor at the College of Pharmacy and a leading regulatory attorney in the food and drug industry that discusses all the different regulations that are applied, laws and regulations that are applied to botanical dietary supplements and many of the FDA's enforcement actions. And the fact of the matter is these herbal supplements and other dietary supplements, vitamins, minerals, etc., are regulated. They may need to be regulated more assertively by FDA, which they've been trying to do at FDA, but they are not drugs. They were not intended to be drugs. Congress made that very clear in their Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act law that you mentioned, Deshaies, in 1994. They are not drugs. And one of the things that I point out, and especially in relation to Dr. Offit's op-ed piece that came out just recently, where he says that if one of these herbal products has what he calls a pharmacological result, that means it's a drug. And that is an astonishingly naive and uninformed statement for somebody who's a physician, trying to understand what's going on in the marketplace. Just because something has a pharmacological effect does not mean it's a drug.
Well, that would be, it would apply to coffee, it would apply to chocolate, right?
It would apply to prunes. I mean, nobody in their right mind who knows how prunes work or knows what they do would ever suggest that a bag of prunes or a bottle of prune juice needs to go through an FDA pre-approval for safety and efficacy before it can be marketed as a medicine, even if you don't want to make a claim for it. And the fact is, as we pointed out to our letter to the editor of the New York Times that we sent in this last Monday, we basically said, if you look at the article that we published in HerbalGram a couple of months ago in our annual herb market report, about 40 to 50%, depending of the top 20 best-selling herbs in the marketplace, both in the mass market and in the health food market, about 40 to 50% of these herbal products are actually traditional conventional foods and or spices. And to take these to suggest that when they're put into a capsule and people take them for some kind of intended health benefit, whatever that might be, believed or actually clinically documented by controlled clinical trials, to suggest that should require an FDA approval as a drug, which would keep these products virtually off the market for years until that drug approval came around, is not only unreasonable but totally ludicrous, and I don't think consumers would stand for that.
Well, absolutely. And just explain what you mean by, FDA approval would be an impediment to these things getting to the marketplace. Why, what's the big deal? That little FDA approval, they can just make sure that things are safe and effective and, no big deal, right?
Well, the Pharmaceutical Research Manufacturers Association estimates that it costs about $500 million to get a new drug approved today, and it takes about 8 to 12 years to get that approval process going. That's to prove that it's supposedly safe and presumably effective according to clinical trials and going through the entire FDA approval process. Now, there is a shorter amended version of that drug approval process now called the botanical drug approach, and botanical drugs, only two have been approved in the last 5 or 6 years. One is a green tea extract that's actually used in a topical cream that's added to the pubic area to help prevent
venereal warts. Yeah,
venereal warts.
HPV.
HPV. Yeah.
Exactly. A lot of people don't know that, but that's very interesting. Yeah. Just comment on that. It shows the power of EGCG as an anti-cancer agent. Talk about briefly about that.
Topically, this is the first botanical drug approved by the FDA in over 50 years. This is actually a green tea extract from China that's extracted in Japan and then formulated into a cream or ointment in Germany and then marketed over here.
It's called polyphenol E or something like that?
That's the name of the extract, and the product is called Verigen, V-E-R-E-G-E-N.
But it's a prescription drug, right? And what you painted on the vaginal area or the penile area for vaginal warts or genital warts, right?
Yeah, if they're HPV-based warts. And what the thing is, this is even though it's not oral, it's topical. This drug went through the amended botanical drug approach. And the FDA set up this new program, oh, about 7 or 8 years ago, saying that if you have a product that's already in the market, like a food, a spice, or a dietary supplement, and you want to try to get a drug claim for it so you can actually treat or prevent a certain kind of condition or disease, we have a more
amended way to do it. Then it becomes medical. It becomes medical, yeah.
It becomes medical. It's a prescription, unless it could never be sold over the counter eventually. And the point is that there's a you ought to do less, or you can totally eliminate, like, animal testing to prove that it's safe, et cetera, and you can go directly to human clinical trials because the safety of the product is, or the material is already believed to be established. The second botanical drug ever approved was approved a year ago. Was the New Year's
Dragon's
Eve
Blood?
Day.
Was it Dragon's Blood or Croton Electric?
Yeah, it's the Dragon's Blood extract from the...
See, I knew that. That's pretty good for a conventional
Not bad for a doctor. Right?
Not too bad, right?
It's the Dragon's Blood extract, and it's for basically for chronic diarrhea in
AIDS patients.
AIDS patients, et cetera. And this is based on an extract of a South American croton tree where actually the blood red extract comes out, it's like a resin that comes out of the bark of the tree when you slice it, and they actually taken some of the materials out of that extract and made a drug out of it. So that's the first oral drug approved by the FDA.
Yeah, I've used that in some patients.
Chemically complex instead of a single chemical.
Mm-hmm. I've used that in some patients.
That one's called crofelemer, or the drug name is Fulizac, Fulyzak, or Zac.
Right. And
strange name.
It's been very well studied. It's actually a traditional Amazonian herb, I take it, right?
Correct. It is. And it's the material from a tree. So it's not the tree itself, but it's actually the resin that comes from the tree, and they sell that in the marketplaces down there. And it's often used for external uses for warts and all kinds of skin problems. But the point I'm making is that these herbal products, even though in some countries they're regulated as drugs under a different type of regulatory system, to say that they have to go through the same type of drug approval process as required for many synthetic prescription drugs that are marketed in the United States that are actually chemicals that we've never even seen on the planet before because they're totally new molecules, doesn't make any sense. And Congress is saying there's no point in taking garlic or ginger or cayenne or turmeric or blueberry extract and other soy and a cranberry. These are some of the top-selling herbal supplements. Right. These are all foods and spices. To make them go through a drug approval just does not make any sense.
Well, as you know, Mark, one of the nut producers, Diamond Food Inc., got in trouble with the FDA because they claimed that walnuts were heart healthy. And they got a regulatory letter a couple of years ago from the Food and Drug Administration saying your walnut products are misbranded because you're making medical and health claims for your walnuts that they're heart healthy, and therefore the walnuts are a drug. And if you do not withdraw these claims, your walnuts are subject to confiscation. We're going to raid your factory, and we're going to grab those misbranded walnuts because they're medication.
Well, this harkens the 25-year-old issue going back to 1988. So that's all about 25 years when I think it was Kellogg's All Brand came out with a colon cancer prevention type of information on it that was actually sponsored by or co-sponsored by the National Cancer Institute, and they said basically eating fiber, eating increased a high fiber diet like the fiber in this box of All Brand has been associated with lower incidence of gastrointestinal cancers, and the actual NCI, the Cancer Institute, actually found that by going with manufacturers and getting these messages, these health-related messages to consumers, was a better way to communicate to people to try to change their lifestyle and their eating habits that are healthier than just trying to do it from the Cancer Institute. The problem was the FDA immediately tried to jump on this and said, wait a minute, you're making All Brand into a drug because you're basically claiming that it helps prevent cancer. So when that went to Congress, and Congress came out with a law called the Nutritional Labeling and Education Act of 1990, which recognized that certain types of food should and do have certain kinds of health benefits, and if those health benefits are adequately confirmed in published clinical trials, that the FDA should allow food manufacturers to put those health claims and health messages on their boxes and packaging, and that gave rise to this whole area and era of communication through foods that have been at least related to disease reduction types of claims. But those are FDA-approved claims. They're not the same as the type of claims that are later were approved or allowed for dietary supplements, which a manufacturer does not have to get a FDA approval for, as long as they notify FDA within 30 days of making the claim that they are making the claim, and the FDA can then object or ask for more information or allow the claim to go on.
It sounds like a free speech issue to me, but it must be very disheartening for you to read articles like that by Dr. Paul Offit. Let's get back to him. Back in June, Dr. Offit was given prime real estate in the op-ed page of the New York Times to write an article entitled, "Don't Take Your Vitamins." I tackled that misguided notion on my radio show and in my podcasts and in blogs, but he has resurfaced, and this is what you're referring to. You wrote a letter to the editor trying to do some damage control on his latest pronouncement, which is entitled "Skip the Supplements." And here's what he has to say. I have a quote from that article. It says, quote, "Until the day comes when medical studies prove that these supplements have legitimate benefits, and until the FDA has the political backing and resources to regulate them like drugs, individuals should simply steer clear." And that aroused your ire, and you wrote a letter to the New York Times, and it remains to be seen whether they're going to publish it, because often, you know, they ignore the critics of their op-ed page. But what did you have to say to the New York Times?
Well, basically, there's a number of things that Dr. Offit points out. Like, for example, he throws out a mythical figure that he says that there's 50,000 adverse events associated with dietary supplements every year, and that is actually not a confirmed fact. That's a made-up estimate from a 2000 report based on the adverse event reports that they're expecting from certain kinds of drugs and veterinary products, etc. So that is not based on dietary supplements. And so, unfortunately, I think Dr. Offit was just picking up some what he thought was going to be a shocking and free piece of information. The FDA said that in 2012 there were 3,200 serious adverse effects reported for herbal and other dietary supplements. 3,000, not 50,000. Big difference. And problem is, people are entitled to their own opinion. However, as they say, you're not entitled to your own facts. And that factoid, that statistic, 50,000 adverse effects associated with supplements, simply is not a credible figure whatsoever. And we actually show that in our letter to the editor. But in addition, we're concerned that he's basically dismissed and or ignores meta-analyses and systematic reviews of numerous published controlled clinical trials on many herbs that show benefit or suggest benefit, and certainly so their safety. And what I mean by systematic review or meta-analysis, as you well know, Ron, is that you take a cluster of clinical trials on a certain herb for associated with certain conditions, and you look at the analytical basis of the design of the trial, and those that make the inclusion criteria are all pooled together, and either the trials collectively show benefit and safety, or they don't, depending on. Again, it's a numbers game. It's a statistical modeling. I give an hour and a half speech at conferences and other places for pharmacists, etc., looking at 25 popular herbs in the marketplace for which clinical trials in systematic reviews and or meta-analyses have been published showing and documenting some type of clinically relevant benefit. And so for people who are dismissing benefits, don't take your vitamins, don't take your herb because they're useless and there's no good, are in many cases either ignorant of the literature or are dismissive of the literature. And the way they can be dismissive of the literature only suggests that they are such strongly biased against these products and this category of products that they are dismissing these things, which I don't believe is in the public health interest and certainly not the interest of their specific patients. Especially when many of these products are made according to good manufacturing practices, made very responsibly, very reliably, and in many cases, or in some cases anyway, clinically tested and shown to be safe and either suggested or confirmed to be effective. So ignoring and dismissing this kind of information is simply not in the public interest, in my view.
And, you know, some people, you so often hear the refrain, you know, if these things were so beneficial, then there would be, you know, scientific studies that would substantiate their benefits. Actually, you know, know, many of my patients report the way they go to the doctor and they say they're taking this or that, the other thing. The doctor says, I never even heard of it. There are no scientific studies about this. It's just folklore. And yet, you know, let's recite some of the contents of the most recent issue of the Herbalgram. You know, what are some of the scientific articles there that deal with real experimental evidence that there's efficacy to various supplements and herbs?
Well, there's not just experimental evidence, there's actually clinical evidence, and I know that you and I mean the same thing, and this is just to be clear, experimental evidence usually refers to animal testing, and we don't report on animal testing in Herbalgram. I mean, we don't dismiss it, but we prefer to look at, human clinical trials, because that is, you know, the better way to do it.
Right.
There's a big one. American ginseng root has been shown clinically safe and effective for reducing cancer-related fatigue.
Nice.
This is a study up in Mayo Clinic. You're probably familiar with
that. That's huge. I mean, so many people getting chemo and radiation, and they're exhausted and tired, debilitated.
Exactly. And it was a fairly good-sized study. And what happens is they've shown just taking an American ginseng product, nothing really fancy, but they took several hundred milligrams or several thousand milligrams, 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams of American ginseng daily, basically increased the level of energy in patients, as self-reported as well as being able to be monitored by their physicians, by the patients who often are extremely drowsy and or fatigued after taking all of these chemotherapy drugs or chemotherapy unit treatments. So basically, there's an adjunct way to help cancer patients undergoing chemotherapy for improving the quality of their life by taking a ginseng product. It's not an extract; just 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams, which is anywhere from 2 to 4 capsules a day. If nothing's fancy, not a huge dose of American ginseng root powder, increases their energy levels sufficiently compared to placebo. Well, why isn't this is getting for some reporting, but why isn't this more widely reported, especially in the oncology areas where I think oncologists should consider including this as part of their regimen or, you know, to the patient's liking. By the way, that same American ginseng has also been shown to be helpful in helping to normalize blood sugar levels in both pre-diabetic and type 2 diabetic patients.
Oh, that's great. What else you got in the latest issue of Herbalgram?
Well, there's one on pelargonium. This is a South African root that's been traditionally used for all kinds of throat problems.
Yeah, we use that for respiratory problems. We have a product called ViraClear that is a tincture of pelargonium that that I personally take whenever I come down with a, you know, sort of scratchy throat or a cold.
Right.
And it doesn't make it go away instantaneously, but it hastens the resolution of a respiratory infection, seems to me, and it works well for many of our patients. What do you got on
there's,
that?
There's actually a meta-analysis of 7 or 8 studies on that South American herb extract that's found in that product, ViraClear, showing that in patients with bronchitis that it's useful, and it's also shown to be useful in tonsillitis. And quite frankly, interestingly, the name of the product, Umkalaoba, which is the Zulu name for it, means something like sore throat. So you have a traditional use noted in the actual name of the plant in its native culture that is suggestive of and is consistent with the clinical trials that have been done on it. But this one is on patients with COPD. Now, how many drugs do you have that are approved by pharmaceutical companies that are safe that are used for COPD, which is obstructive pulmonary disease? Here's the first trial that actually tested COPD for this product that otherwise shows very good upper respiratory tract infection type of activity, and here they tried it on COPD and it came out positive. So we're reporting on that because we think that this is something that has got, again, overlooked in the literature. These were published this year in a journal called Respiratory Medicine. So there's all kinds of trials coming out every month that are positive on herbs, especially some of the pooled trials, like the systematic reviews and meta-analyses where you take, you know, 10, 20, 30 trials that might meet the inclusion criteria, many of which show positive effects for some of these herbs, and this is being virtually ignored in the media, particularly, and in many cases ignored in the medical profession as well. And I think that's a disservice to the consumer.
Indeed it is, and especially now that the drumbeat is supplements are worthless, don't even bother taking supplements. I think that that's a real poisoning of the well for Americans who want to undertake enlightened self-care in this era when, certainly there are some drawbacks and deficiencies in our medical system.
Well, exactly. So anybody who would say that there's no document effect, you mentioned the Amahad O'Connor story that came out November 5th about the DNA barcoding, when he talked about unproven herbal remedies. I mean, right there in the first sentence, he was basically dismissing any value for these whatsoever. And what's more, look, there's problems with their quality. Well, the fact is, you can't dismiss a priori many of the documented health benefits of these products, because as the research continues to explode in this area, many of the research findings done by appropriate, controlled, well-designed clinical trials are showing positive benefits.
So what's the call to action to our listeners of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast? How can they get the information that you share monthly in the Herbalgram, or how can they become part of ABC?
Well, we're at herbalgram.org. We are an international herbal medicine think tank. We are independent. We accept funding from all kinds of sources, which include consumers, health professionals, researchers, industry, and other sources, universities, libraries, etc. herbalgram.org. We have a monthly e-newsletter that has original content that's peer-reviewed in the quarterly journal Herbalgram, available online and also in print in a beautiful publication that's got four-color photography and just really beautiful. Our latest issue is our issue number 100. We're 25 years old now, and we've been around a long time. We hope to be around another 25 years. And I think the call to action here is that there are many herbal products that are worthy of people's consideration, many that are actually manufactured according to appropriate good manufacturing practices by responsible, ethical, reliable companies. Many of these herbal products are actually clinically tested. We show them. And by the way, every time we mention a research review that we test, where we actually evaluate and summarize these clinical trials, we always mention the brand name of the herb and the company that makes it. Not to promote the company, not to endorse the brand, but we're trying to show people that many of these herbs are really not generic. They're not necessarily commodities. That some of these clinically tested brands are special extracts that are available from one company or just are not the same as some of the products on the marketplace. And if you really want to make sure that your product is reliable, one of the criteria you may want to employ, aside from looking for various seals on the bottle to make sure that the manufacturer might be hopefully using appropriate good manufacturing practices, look for products that are clinically tested, because products that have been shown to be safe and effective in published clinical trials are certainly one of the ways you can determine whether an herbal preparation might be appropriate for you.
You know, you have three decades of perspective on this industry. You know, you got started when you were real young, and the industry was immature. What's your assessment of the progress that the herbal industry has made over the past decades, and where do you think it's headed?
Well, actually, I've been in the herbal community for 40 years, four decades now. I'm in my fifth decade now.
I didn't want to out you on that.
That's okay. That's all right. And I've actually been studying herbs for over 45 years, and I've been a vegetarian that long as well. So I'm really into the plant situation. And let me say something. People talk about the industry. Let me say there's several different layers of what's called the industry. There's several industries. There are responsible, ethical manufacturers that put out very reliable products in many cases. And there are many companies out there, unfortunately, who are out there simply for a fast buck. They're not really looking at the quality control like they should be. They shouldn't be. They're not checking out the quality of their ingredients. And sometimes they're making outrageous and undocumented and unsubstantiable claims. And there's people in the middle. So there are two or three different industries. It's a very fractionated, it's a very heterogeneous industry. It's not monolithic. And so it's hard to say the industry this or the industry that, because there's really so many different players out there. There's five different trade associations. Our organization, by the way, is an independent, nonprofit group. We deal with industry issues. We deal with consumer issues. We deal with health professional issues, because at the end of the day, we're trying to help improve the quantity and the quality of information out there, especially the scientific information that supports, in many cases, the historical and traditional uses of many of these herbal materials.
Well, you're doing a phenomenal job, and I want to congratulate you. And you really have provided great clarity on an issue which I think is of prime concern to many of our listeners. And keep up the great work. Mark Blumenthal, who is the originator and the head of the American Botanical Council. President, is that the term?
I'm actually called the founder and executive director, but that's, you know. Exactly. Whatever. What originator sounds good to me too.
You know, chief Indian, whatever, tribal chieftain.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, so thank you very much for joining us. And once again, it's herbalgram.com, is it?
No, herbalgram.org. We're an independent nonprofit, ORG.
Great. Thank you very much, Mark, for joining us, and we'll have you on again soon for another
Thank
update.
You, Ron. I'm Dr. Very much appreciated.
My pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce, and so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the intelligent medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.